Okay, so this forum is on the question of Syria. It's hosted by Consistent Democrats, and the title is Regime Change Funded by US and Israel, Drive Imperialists Out of West Asia Region. That is the title of what I'm going to be going to talk about today. First of all, I'd like to say that the fall of Syria's government is probably the most important geopolitical event since the 7th of October 2023, with the Gaza breakout that was led by Hamas. But this is a defeat for the Axis of Resistance, the Iranian-led anti-imperialist bloc that's been the only body that's delivered real physical solidarity with the Palestinians in the past year of genocide in Gaza. And of course, that genocide has spread by degrees to the West Bank to a degree, and is likely to do so more, I think. Three different forces have taken direct military action against Israel to varying degrees to challenge Israel's proclaimed right to slaughter Palestinians. And they are the Amanullah movement in Yemen, which is known as the Houthi, Hezbollah in Lebanon, and the Islamic Republic in Iran. All three of these components of this axis of resistance are of Islamist origin, based on the Shia, which is the smaller of the two major confessional groups in Islam. And obviously, as Marxists and atheists, we do not endorse the ideology of these movements. They don't represent our politics. However, we do support the resistance of the Palestinian people against genocide. And any movement that resists genocide is given credit where due by Marxists. And of course, as I said, the ideologies of these movements are not ours, but if they take actions against oppression, the basis exists for communists to work alongside their supporters in struggles to resist oppression and genocide. And we don't regard such bourgeois religious movements as monolithic. We give credit where it's due in terms of any progressive evolution among them. And it should be noted that these movements have actively opposed religious sectarianism over the last period. I mean, the breakout from Gaza concentration camp, which is now an extermination camp that rivals Auschwitz, actually, was led by Hamas, which is a Sunni Islamic movement, albeit one with a de facto bourgeois national liberationist program. And we don't share the politics of Hamas, of course, either. But we do support the Palestinian people's right to resist genocide and incarceration in a giant murder camp. And that's a progressive struggle, notwithstanding the religious illusions of the cadres and masses involved. And of course, not all the Palestinians that are fighting for their rights are Muslims. A large minority are actually Orthodox Christians, and Zionism has massacred them also. So all acts of resistance against ethnic persecution by Zionists on behalf of Arab Muslims, Christians, or people of no religion are progressive. And as Marxists, we seek to fight alongside them against oppression by the method of the United Front. So we applaud and embrace the anti-sectarian impulse of the Axis of Resistance, where Shia Iranians, Lebanese, and Yemenis stood up to the Zionists and championed the cause of mainly Sunni and Christian Palestinians. And in that sense, Marxists regard themselves as critical supporters of this as an aspect of the anti-imperialist United Front. This is support for anti-imperialism, not for religious radicalism. The non-sectarianism is a progressive move away from the logic of religious radicalism into the realm of secularism, which is a key part of the communist and genuinely anti-imperialist worldview. Now, other religious radicals, particularly among the Sunni confessional group, appear much into anti-Shia, anti-Christian sectarianism, as we can see from the actions of HTS, which is supported by Turkey, the US, and Israel. But more on that later. We also note that a lesser but still very important role was played in this de facto anti-imperialist, anti-Zionist United Front by the Syrian government under Assad. It may not have been obvious, but as there were no spectacular military actions by Syria against Israel. But the repeated armed attacks by Israel on Iranian military people and diplomatic premises in Syria indicate the role that Syria was playing in helping the supply of Iranian military and other support to Hezbollah. The Assad regime was, in a low-key manner, allowing its territory to be used as a bridge between Iran and those in Lebanon who wanted to act to defend the Palestinians. And that was and is very important. It's now under threat from the rise to power of sectarian, imperialist-backed jihadists in Syria. Like this group called Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, HTS, which actually means Organization for the Liberation of the Levant, apparently. And they said that their only enemies are Iran and Hezbollah, not Israel. And in the context of the genocide against the Palestinians, that's just utterly treasonous. Since HTS have seized power in Syria, there have been bans on the celebration of Christmas by the numerous Syrian Christians, and massacres of the Alawites, which is the smaller Shia grouping that the Assad family also belong to. And Druze are now living in fear of reprisal, the Druze population, particularly in southern Syria. And the Kurdish population in the north and east of Syria, who've often in the past sought Western support for their struggles for separation, or at least autonomy, they're under attack, not from Assad, but from sectarian Sunni elements, backed by Turkey, of course. The Assad-Ba'ath regime in the past, for all its austere repressive aspects, prided itself on its secularism and refusal to persecute communities on religious grounds. And it actually gained popular support for that, from that, during the civil war. It did not tolerate Kurdish separatism, of course, and Kurds were oppressed and discriminated against, as in all the national states that include significant Kurdish populations in the region. But even Kurds at times regarded Assad as a lesser evil to jihadist Sunni sectarians. So that's a national question. Although we're for the right of self-determination for the Kurds, that does not derogate from the right of self-determination for the Arab peoples of the Middle East, which is particularly at stake in questions related to the genocidal colonial project of Zionism, whose entire basis is the forcible confiscation of Palestinian land and the ethnic cleansing and indeed destruction of the Palestinian people. And because of the similarity of the Palestinian people to other Arab populations of the region, Israel has an intrinsic tendency to seek to destroy every strong Arab or even sympathetic Muslim country in the West Asia, Middle East region. And that's because they know full well that they're guilty of genocidal crimes against Arabs. And completely naturally, Arabs and other sympathetic Muslim peoples will seek to overturn this oppression and destroy the Zionist supremacist project. Now, Zionism actually has a disproportionate power and influence amongst the imperialist countries of the West. And that's simply based on the disproportionate numerical preponderance of Jews in the Western ruling classes compared to the number of Jews in the population. And that's a legacy of many centuries before capitalism, when Jews played an economic role as a commodity trading middleman class within the feudal natural economies before capitalism. And that made them particularly suited culturally and in terms of their legacy for particular roles in the capitalist ruling classes that succeeded feudalism. And this is a very potted summary, but what it also provides is a material basis for the disproportionate role of the Israel lobby today. Israel as a state was created to benefit that very sizable Jewish layer of the imperialist bourgeoisie. And even if they don't live there, they tend to regard it as in some way their state. It's basically a transplanted imperialist enclave with its own imperialist interests. And all of Israel was taken from the Arab people by genocidal means. And in a way, that sums up the main issue in the Middle East, the main issues, actually. The film Wall Street was the epitome of neoliberalism in the 1980s. It had a character called Gordon Gekko, who was played by Michael Douglas, who was remembered particularly for the notorious soundbite that greed is good. You know, I mean, when you hear imperialist politicians like Starmer or Biden or Blinken or Trump even, who say that Israel is only defending itself when it commits some outrageous massacre or act of aggression against neighbouring Arab peoples, like in Syria, they're solidarising with a state founded on genocide. So I would argue what they're actually saying is, when they're saying Israel has a right to defend itself, they're effectively saying that genocide is good, you know, because that's what it stands for. That's what this means in reality, you know. The coalition of interests here, that of the Jewish Zionist bourgeoisie, both in Israel and in the wider imperialist countries, who have a direct interest in Israel's land theft and genocidal practices. And Gaza was only the culmination of this so far, anyway. And there's also the other aspect of it is the more general colonialist interests of the imperialist powers and their desire to possess, and when they do possess, to hang on to the natural resources of this region, of the West Asia, Middle East region, notably oil, of course, which in many cases they seized in the 19th or 20th centuries. And those two tend to cross-fertilise. So you see hybrid forms. You see like virulent evangelical Christian Zionists in the United States who are as virulent in their genocidal anti-Arab views as Netanyahu, you know. And those people are fellow travellers of Zionism, like Mike Huckabee, you know, who's the one of the key people in the Trump administration, who says Palestinians do not exist. Yeah. Or you see European imperialist Zionists like Starmer, who arise from pro-imperialist social democracy and well bribed by the Israel lobby. And that's in the context of wars and genocides in the Middle East. And it's also in the context of what's happened in Syria, you know. So, the social basis of some forms of religious radicalism in Muslim countries has frequently come from two sources, from the older conservative landlord-type classes, often rooted in the remnants of pre-capitalist modes of production. And while these may be socially backward and obsolete, they still wield considerable social power, because imperialist capitalism in the West, in its colonising activities, seeks to suppress native capitalist development in colonial and former colonial countries. And they're still able to do this in many places that are formally decolonized because of their control of the mainstreams of finance or their ownership, either directly or indirectly, of important economic resources in those former colonial countries. And Afghanistan was a case in point when there's a reformist pro-USSR government came to power in 1978, the West were able to initiate a jihad against it using reactionary Islamic forces that had their starting point in the pre-capitalist landlord class. And the question of women's rights and the bribe price was basic, and that's what started that war. And that was the starting point of the Mujahideen, who waged a holy war against the People's Democratic Party of Afghanistan and then the USSR, which backed them with military force between 1979 and around 1988. The USSR was actually in there. There are also educated layers of the middle class in many of these Muslim countries who can be drawn to this kind of radicalism. As for all their education, they have relatively few outlets for employment, you know. So jihadism has also become a movement of an ostensibly modernist middle class who seek to update these religious concepts and make a modern movement out of them. And such movements can veer to the left, you know, often in contradictory ways. One example of that, for a while at least, was the Mujahideen Erkalk, the organization of people's Mujahideen in Iran, who defined themselves as Islamic Marxists in the period of the 1978-79 Iranian Revolution. But subsequently, they sold themselves to anybody who was opposed to Khomeini's regime as it consolidated itself. They became completely demoralized politically. And they sold themselves to Saddam Hussein, and then they later to the CIA. And you now see them working with Iranian monarchists in some of these dreadful demonstrations that hang around London at various points. You know, but it's arguable there were elements of left populism mixed with conservative Islamic sentiment in the Iranian regime, as well as in Hezbollah and the Houthi. You know. Whereas others, particularly amongst the Sunni radicals, have tended to be more uniformly right-wing and sectarian, starting with Al-Qaeda, which grew out of the Afghan jihad against the Soviet Union and had a particular love-hate relationship with both US imperialism and the Zionists. I mean, Bin Laden and his followers are trained by the CIA, particularly for war against the USSR, but they turned against the US seemingly in the most dramatic ways, like 9/11. You know, they also sometimes expressed antipathy for Israel, and yet they were evidently and knowingly used by Zionists. Yeah. With the bombings of the US embassies in Kenya and Tanzania in the late 1990s, those are bloody attacks, but they killed mainly black Africans. And then there had 9/11, the attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. And yet there's, you know, there is evidence or there is grounds to suspect that both the Israelis and the Americans knew about these attacks before they were going to happen, you know. And there's all sorts of strange sort of elements to this that indicate foreknowledge or possible involvement by these forces in these actions. And of course, the result of it was the political Islamophobic hysteria in the imperialist countries that was obviously manipulated by imperialism and gave the opportunity for the US to use this not only to invade Afghanistan, which is where Al-Qaeda and Bin Laden were actually based, but also to invade Iraq. And I don't think Afghanistan really mattered very much to Zionists. But Iraq certainly did, and the 9/11 attacks provided the opportunity for pro-Israeli neocons to enlist US imperialism more generally to destroy Iraq. And out of the destruction of Iraq, of course, you see a further deepening of this. You know, you see the US destruction of Fallujah with chemical and uranium radiological weapons, uranium, you know, depleted uranium, etc. You saw the further mutation of Al-Qaeda, an Al-Qaeda movement that emerged after the invasion and killing of Saddam into something even worse, which was Islamic State, you know, which I would consider to be an Islamic version of the Khmer Rouge, as a product of collective psychological derangement in conditions of rampant barbarism and slaughter. And they went on to slaughter virtually anyone or anything that got in their way. But like the original Khmer Rouge, they were actually still capable of and willing to be bribed by imperialism. So all those forces were mobilized by imperialism in Syria since the eruption of the Arab Spring in 2011. And what was the Arab Spring? It was a spontaneous, many-country upsurge of democratic process at the repressive and anti-democratic nature of most of the bourgeois regimes in the Arab world. And it briefly convulsed many countries, both with radical and conservative Arab regimes, you know. But it was a naive upheaval, and it was very easy for the imperialists to co-opt it. And in countries with pro-Western regimes, such as Egypt, it was indulged for a little while and then crushed. You know, the Egyptian masses were allowed to elect as their president Mohamed Morsi of the Muslim Brotherhood. And then as soon as that movement had been demobilized, he was overthrown and executed, in fact, in a bloody coup by the current leader of Egypt, General Sisi. You know, and in Libya, the movement was rapidly co-opted into an imperialist intervention that destroyed what actually was the most prosperous country in Africa, that murdered its leader, who the Zionists, Gaddafi, who the Zionists particularly hated because of his support for Palestinian causes. And it collapsed the whole society, which ended up a total disaster, even ridden with things like slave markets for black Africans, you know. And they attempted to do the same with Syria, more or less at the same time, but they failed because of the intervention of Iran and Hezbollah and Russia, who put a stop to these attacks and thwarted them. So that's what the Syrian civil war that's raged since 2011 was about. The Syrian Muslim Brotherhood, which had engaged in bloody armed conflict with the Assads earlier on, under Bashir Assad's father, Hafiz al-Assad, was actually co-opted by the pro-Turkish, pro-Western campaign against the Assads, which included al-Qaeda. And it does appear that the Erdogan government's antipathy to Assad was in part because of their rejection of Assad's rejection of the project of an oil pipeline through Syria from Qatar that would go through Turkey into Europe, which would enrich Turkey considerably if it were built. And it may well be built now. That's a possibility. I mean, I argue that the demonization of Assad is largely rubbish. Assad's regime was bad, but no worse than most other bourgeois nationalist movement, governments in the global south. There are many worse. Why don't the Zionists and neocons who rant on about the supposed evil of Assad have anything to say about the monstrous terror in Egypt from Sisi, which executed the only elected president in Egyptian history, as Morsi, And the reason they don't say anything about it is because Sisi is an ally of Israel. And the Assad regime's anomaly was it rejected such alliances with Israel. And the war against it was raged not because of its allegedly barbaric and repressive features, but because it resisted cooperation with imperialism and Zionism to a degree. I'm not saying it resisted everything, not at all, but it resisted some of the most important demands of imperialism. And when these people start talking about morality and freedom, you look at their bottom line, which is profit, profit from imperialism. That's what they're really going on about. So what's the outcome of this? I'd say that Syria has collapsed into chaos and sectarian murder now stalks the land. The Assad regime eventually succumbed to sanctions, which since Syria had no significant oil reserves of its own, it was not able to counter indefinitely. And eventually it couldn't pay its troops, so the army wouldn't fight. And that's what happened, basically. Its defenders, its previous defenders, such as Russia and Iran and Hezbollah, were tied up in other military conflicts in Ukraine and with Israel, and were unable to do very much to aid it, especially as the army had effectively collapsed in morale anyway. So the whole thing collapsed in the face of an HTS offensive from its enclave in Idlib, which had existed since the conflict was frozen in 2020. And now Israel has launched the most incredible piratical armed campaign to wipe out Syria's armed capacity, its weaponry, its military bases, its navy, etc., etc. And suddenly the HTS, who is led by al-Jolani, who actually wears clothes branded as Made in Israel. This has been pointed out that the rebranding of the attire he uses, which appears to resemble the attire of Zelensky in Ukraine, who's another imperialist stooge, is made in Israel. And his new regime is now complaining to the UN that Israel's attacks are against international law. Well, no shit, Sherlock, as they might say. The HTS is said to be a split from Al-Qaeda, from Al-Nusra, which was the Syrian Al-Qaeda group. But in fact, it's just a reshuffle. It's a reshuffle of names. It's a rebranding, and just a few days earlier, as they took power, they proclaimed that their only enemies were Iran and Hezbollah, and that Israel was no problem, They sought friendly relations with Israel. That's what they said. And they talked about democracy and a new constitution. And
Yeah.
it's cynical talk when they're slaughtering adherents of the wrong religion. You know, they announced that henceforth Israel would be run on free market principles as opposed to the at least nominal adherence to planning and by the and such by the Syrian Baathists. You know, and they've decreed that no woman can be a judge, which was commonplace under the supposedly evil Assad regime. And any court case with a woman judge would have to change to a male judge. You know, they decreed that 400,000 Shia who gained Syrian citizenship under the last 50, over the last 50 years under the rule of the Ba'ath Socialist Party will be deprived of citizenship and expelled. And in fact, thousands of such people are fleeing Syria as we speak. And meanwhile, the West has begun sending back Syrian refugees because Syria is supposedly safe. Now it's run by people who were originally in ISIS. You know, it's surreal. The persecuted today are victims of Western proxies are likely to be refused asylum in the West, whereas those who supported the proxies in the previous dozen or so years were given asylum. And the HTS has also decreed that journalists who reported for the Assad regime will be punished. In other words, they're going to be killed, basically. You know, so that's democracy. You've got economics for the wealthy. You've got legally mandated oppression of women. You've got persecution of minorities, murder of press people. You know, and calling that democracy is a complete nonsense. But the Syrian population may well have other ideas. I think there's a fight around democracy against the CIA, Zionist, jihadi stooges is quite likely in due course, you know. And of course, if there's one thing that that Zionism fears above all in the Arab world, it's democracy. They fear it because the Arab peoples of the region regard the Zionist regime as their most dangerous enemies. And all Israel's allies in the region are the most brutal dictatorships like Sisi's Egypt and royal dictatorships in Jordan and Saudi Arabia. They have pride of place, you know. And in places where there's even a modicum of democratic space, such as Lebanon, militant opponents of Zionism, such as Hezbollah, rapidly become dominant. So in an environment where dictatorships are dominant, Assad is one of these who was hostile to Zionism, was an anomaly. And the Sunni Islamists, with their sectarian brutality and their aspiration to be clients of imperialism, are likely the source of another brutal dictatorship. So, you know, in the post-Assad context, opposing these dictatorial trends and demanding the popular election of a government to stand up to Zionism and its genocidal Greater Israel aspirations are crucial. And we need a further elaboration of democratic demands, such as the need for a constituent assembly and democratic rights more generally, not least to bury these kinds of pro-Zionist dictatorial trends, you know. And in that sense, I'd argue that this is where it all merges into the question of permanent revolution, you know, that the revolution against Zionism is inseparable from the permanent revolution of the Arab masses against their ruling classes. And that has the potential not just to overthrow all the various bourgeois Arab regimes in the region, but to crack the Zionist fortress itself. I think it's about the only thing that would, you know. So I'll leave it there and I'll open it up to discussion, if that's all right, comrades. Yeah. Cheers. Who wants to speak? Mark and Diana.
Yeah, thanks for that, Ian. What I fail to understand is even taking into account their overconfidence of support from financial support by the US, for example, and certain groups they probably made promises to in Syria, why Israel would still aerial bombard Syria within a few hours of the change of regime? totally disregarding who you know might get killed in the as a consequence. Obviously, Israel won't care about that, but you would have thought Syrians who might otherwise have supported them would have cared about that. Yeah, I just don't understand that how they can be so overconfident that it they're not thinking of the consequences of their actions on their supporters, is what I'm saying.
Sure. Who else? Diana, you want to speak here?
Yeah, I'd like to know just how despotic and oppressive Assad was, because there's all these stories about him imprisoning people and them being tortured and stuff. I'm not aware of any of these released prisoners, genuine ones, being exposed in the media. I steer clear of the mainstream media, I must admit. But today, on the Crispin Flintoff thingy, saw an amazing manufactured one. This guy being let out of prison with this beautifully manicured beard and nice haircut. But I don't have a view about Assad one way or another, but I would, if he was being that bad, I'd like to see the evidence. The other thing is, didn't he actually hold some elections?
Simon.
Yeah, maybe I missed it, maybe you actually said, but could you maybe say a little bit more about why Sunni radical Islam is more consistently right wing than the Shia variations? Is it connected to some differences of social forces? Because you said in Afghanistan and all over, it was common to the colonial experience that landlordism remained powerful because indigenous capitalism was kind of held back. And you did also talk about the Khmer Rouge and so forth, but, you know, Islamic State being similar to some of the more extreme hysterics of Maoism. I mean, is that the explanation for it, or are there more complexities involved in differences in the social dynamics and classes behind the two different forms of radical Islam?
Okay, just in terms of, I'll come back on Mark's question first. Why are they so complacent about the Israelis bombing them? I think they're beginning to wake up to the fact that they are being pulverized, that the military Israel's policy is to pulverize the military power of Syria while the Syrian government is paralyzed, which it is. You know, these people actually regard Israel mistakenly, delusionally, they regard Israel is in some sense a friendly regime. They want to be friends with Israel. Israel does not want to be friends with its neighboring Arab peoples. It wants to disarm them and pulverize them. But these people are delusional cretins and fanatics who are long conditioned to regard their main enemy as the Shia. And that makes them suckers, to put it bluntly, you know, suckers for the Zionist propaganda and suckers for the program of Zionism, which is to disarm and destroy the power of the surrounding population. I don't know what I mean in terms of the repressive character of Assad. I think it's been exaggerated. I think his father, Hafez al-Assad, was pretty brutal at times, actually. And there was a revolt in Hama in 1981 by the Muslim Brotherhood against what they saw as despotic persecution, in a sense, persecution of Muslim radicals. I think the Muslim Brotherhood is somewhat different from the Muslim Brotherhood is somewhat different from Al-Qaeda. The Muslim Brotherhood is, although there are stories that the Muslim Brotherhood was promoted by the British, etc., going back to the 20s, the Muslim Brotherhood has a much more contradictory history, and it has resisted Zionism. You know, the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood actually sent volunteers into Palestine to fight against the Zionist Nakba in 1948. So I wouldn't completely write them off as the same. But since the Arab Spring and since the well, really since Cold War II, what broke out in Afghanistan and related things since, there has been a systematic training of Muslim radicals, of Sunni Muslim radicals, by the United States to carry out its various objectives in Afghanistan, particularly. And I think the difference between Iran and Afghanistan is that Iran was a conflict against a regime that was put in power by the United States and Britain in the 50s. You know, the overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran was an American and British reactionary action on behalf of Zionism, and it the resistance to it over time, as it culminated in the revolution of 1979, actually gave the, it meant that the Shia Islamic movement was forged in a struggle against an imperialist puppet regime, whereas the Sunni Islamist movement was forged in a struggle against a progressive left nationalist regime in Afghanistan. And those two big influence on the character of the various Islamic movements. So there's a left populist element to the Khomeiniite movement, even though obviously it carried out Sharia law, it carried out some pretty retrograde and backward positions and actions. Nevertheless, there was an element of it that was genuinely directed against imperialism. But that's not true of the Sunni movement in general. They've tend, apart from the blip of the Muslim Brotherhood, the predominant in the last few decades, it's predominantly been a tool of the US to fight things like the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, and it's now been used in Iraq. It was used it's now been used in Syria. Similar things were done in Libya as well, you know. And I think it's just a part of the history, the recent history in the last few decades, is that Sunni Islamism has been consciously manipulated as a counter-revolutionary weapon by the US, and Shia Islamism is not as not. It's actually tending to clash with the US much more frontal character, and it's changed, sort of giving it a different political thrust. Obviously, these are not movements we support. We don't approve of their religious program, their non-secular programs. But they are. I think there is a difference between them. That's what's shown up in this conflict. Yeah. That's my explanation for it anyway. It's concrete politics, really. Sorry, Susan. I don't know if that helps.
Okay. I think the split between Sunni and Shia should be looked at for those who care about it, in the same way that Christianity is split between Catholicism and Protestantism. And the, you know, if you look back a few hundred years at the Hundred Years' War, at the horrendous amount of killings, yes, executions, Spanish Inquisition, torture, witchcraft, wild that went on there. You know, in the West, it's all very easy for us to sit there and look at this and say, oh, that. But the thing we're forgetting is that this is about the ruling class in the imperialist countries using antipathies, which are religious, deeply held beliefs. But the reality is the imperialists used tribalism, which they recognized as, you know, it's a form of both ethnicity and a desire to maintain the status quo that certain groups have and are often minorities. So if you look at all the kingdoms that, you know, that were set up after World War One, whether it's Jordan or Dubai, you know, all of those, they are all about monarchies that come from small minorities which are seen as easy to manipulate because the majority of their population are different. If we're looking at the slaughter that's happening, it's happening because it's convenient. As far as the getting rid of all the munitions in Syria, particularly the naval fleet and the aircraft, this is about, I found it interesting that Vanessa Bealey was talking about a transition, that Assad was planning to go within the next 6 months and hand over to an elected government, and that was what was kiboshed, because Turkey was ready to move in and try and take the bits that it could because of the pipeline, the oil pipeline that they want to go through, which Turkey's sees it as solving its financial problems. And Israel basically, and the CIA / Kurds, who you should remember were responsible for the Crocus bombing. You know, they are responsible for horrific acts of terrorism against both Russia and other countries, Iran in particular. We're looking at a geopolitical channel that allows the Americans or the CIA / MI6, however you see it, to funnel terrorists from one battleground to another. They funnel terrorists from Libya, Afghanistan to Libya, from Libya to now Syria. They are moving these mercenaries all over the world. I'm quite sure when Ukraine falls that they will be, you know, moving Ukrainian mercenaries to the next hotspot that they want in the war against China. But we are not we are looking at Syria and asking how did it happen, when the reality is it was on a hit list. It's been on that hit list since the 1990s. And the shocking thing for the Western ruling class was how long it has taken for Syria to fall, how long the economic sanctions, the horrendous starvation of Syria that until Gaza came along would, if we had looked at it, would have been every bit as horrific. The fact that they wouldn't even allow them to rebuild after the damage of the earthquake, because of the Caesar sanctions, you know, because they weren't even allowed concrete to rebuild their houses, and that both Iran and Russia offered them support in order to do this transition, and that the reason why HTS are, shall we say, sheep-dipped to look like, you know, nice, friendly, what do they call them? Woke terrorists. You know, they're woke rebels now instead of being head-chopping, you know, terrorists, is because of our Western propaganda. Vanessa Bealey was quite clear that Assad was perfectly capable of driving himself around in his own car without a bodyguard. If he had been the horrendous evil dictator that we've been, you know, brainwashed with for the last decade, he would not have been able to do that. And I came across people on YouTube saying, oh, yes, you know, he must drive a Rolls Royce. I'm sitting there, or a Ferrari, and I'm going, he never drove any of those. What are you talking about? You obviously never actually saw him. It's just that's how a dictator behaves. It's not how Traore behaves, but it's how they perceive the people. You know, it's Zelensky who's the one who's got all the houses in Miami and Paris and London and, you know, where he's going to go with his billions. But no, there's no sign of that with Assad. In fact, I think the biggest reason why he fled to Moscow was the realization that the likes of Newland and Clinton, Hillary Clinton, that is, wanted him strung up on a lamppost and ideally, you know, raped to death the way that Gaddafi was. You know, this is how, you know, this is how disgusting the people at the top of our ruling class are. And they don't care about how many Syrians die any more than they did how many Libyans have died. They don't even care about the Ukrainians except for the ones who survive. So we've got to look at Syria as a bunch of dominoes that have been, you know, it's the last straw that broke the camel's back. It's the last few, the last fortnight is the culmination of 25 years of increasing horrific financial, economic, and actually terrorist oppression. No? You know, we may be surprised by it, but that's because we're always surprised by our acts of genocide. And, you know, it took Declassified to point out that just how many horrific things the British did in Kenya, or why we're still bombing Yemen. You know, what gives us the right to bomb Yemen? What gives us the, you know, what gives any of them the right to do it? They do it because they can, and because we don't stop them. Not our, but their. Yes. Oh, they're woke jihadists. Sorry. Yes, Ukrainian mercenaries were also flying some drones to keep the terrorists safe, and they were complaining about how, well, Syria hasn't modernized its army enough to deal with modern warfare. And I'm going, can anybody? No? But I think we have to look at Syria as one more piece in this kaleidoscope of what does this bode for what is going to happen in the Middle East next. And I, you know, I think it's too close to call whether Iran will push back, which it has to because it's next on the shopping list for Netanyahu, or whether it's going to strengthen ties with Iraq, who desperately want to get rid of the American bases out of, and start to fall back into becoming a Persian and Arab Union against the client states that are places like Jordan and Saudi Arabia. No? And where the dismemberment of Syria is going to lead us in the future. Anyway, that's my two pence. Sorry, I've wandered around a bit, but you can see where I'm coming from.
Yeah, you're asked to speak.
Yeah.
Who wants to speak? Well, I'll say a few words in that case. Just on the on the question of what's likely to happen next, I was listening to Vanessa Beebe earlier on, and what she thinks is the most likely, you know, once is the spreading of this conflict into Iraq is highly likely. In some form, because of obviously the origins of ISIS are in Iraq, you know, and the origins of this movement are, you know, of what's effectively taken power in Syria is also basically a result of Al-Qaeda in Iraq and ISIS. You know, they are products of that. So it's highly likely that conflict will spread into Iraq as part of targeting Iran, you know. The sectarian project of the Sunni jihadist is, they do see, they have stated explicitly, they think that Iran is their main enemy, you know. So I think it is highly likely, but it will come up against a big problem if it tries to spread into Iran, which is that the bulk of the Iranian population, sorry, of the Iraqi population is Shia. Although there is obviously a Sunni minority, but even the Sunni minority has had some pretty bad experiences of these people, and a big chunk of it anyway, you know. And they will be there's potential. One of the things that ISIS done that's paradoxical, but has paradoxically has a good aspect to it. In an antagonistic way, is it's obliterated the Sykes-Picot line between Iraq and Syria. Now, logically, those countries belong together anyway. You know, they belong in some sort of federal arrangement. And of course, ISIS was a terribly reactionary development, but nevertheless, it did obliterate that line. And obliterating that line, and actually, you know, poses the question of a progressive solution across that line, you know, and I think there is potential for resistance to these people. I don't know exactly how it will grow up. I think it's far too early to say, but I don't think the populations will simply accept being tortured and murdered and sliced to pieces by people who have an extreme sectarian program that really is not that different from ISIS. We've already seen massacres of Alawites and the threat of it to eject 500,000 Shia almost, you know, all the other things that have been, you know, projected that have happened even in the last week or two since this happened, you know, some pretty nasty stuff is already happening. And I don't think it will be just tolerated by the population. There are elements of the Syrian army who are trying to organise a resistance in the area around Lebanon, in the mountainous areas around Lebanon. Who knows what the potentialities are, actually, you know. Okay, sure. Simon is going. I think there are potential, you know. It's just too early to say, but I think there will be blowback. There will be resistance to all this stuff. And of course, from the point of view of imperialism, they tolerate the behaviour of these Sunni Islamists. Even despite 9/11 and despite all the various other, you know, actions that that some of these Islamists have taken against the United States, actually, they still fund them. They still regard them as worth funding. You know, like Salman Abedi, the guy who bombed who attacked the Manchester Arena, right? He was working for MI6, you know. Yeah. But he was an Islamic terrorist who massacred young girls at a concert in Manchester. But he was working for MI6. It's incredible that they can do this stuff, but it happens. They tolerate it because they're more useful to them than their bloodthirsty proclivities that are sometimes directed against Western civilians would allow. You know, they're more useful to them than that. And I don't think that. I think people will not tolerate this, and Iraqis and Syrians will not tolerate this indefinitely. And I certainly don't think Iraqis will tolerate it if it spreads into Iraq. But I think there is the basis for a fight back against it, which may well involve Shia Islamists, actually, who as long as they keep, you know, as long as they don't embrace a sectarian counter program to the Sunni sectarianism, then and stick to the apparently non-sectarian attitude of Hezbollah, they are allies, or they can be allies in such a struggle, in a united front against these imperialist mercenaries, which is what they are, basically. Yeah. But we obviously we are not simply supporters of these of this politics. We need a communist party. We need communist politics in this situation. And that's an important missing ingredient. But there are histories of communism in all these countries. You know, there are communist parties. There are subjective communists of various descriptions. And obviously we can't just talk to the Muslim radicals who are amenable to being talked to, being worked with. We have to regroup communists if we can. You know. And build a communist movement, or do what we can to influence the building of a communist movement. Anyway, who else wants to speak, if anybody? Diana?
Yeah, I'm probably stating the obvious, but I see Israel's aim being to commit a total genocide against the people of Syria, just as they are with the Palestinians, just to grab that land. Well, I really hope they're going to be resisted, because the resistance has been weakened, but I hope it's not dead.
My understanding is that Iran has already said it's got plenty of other routes to get weapons through. What worries me is there seems to be some indication of a separation between Hezbollah and Hamas, and which of those actually truly represent the Palestinian people, as opposed to which ones are seem to be somehow sort of secretly following the Zionist agenda, at least when it financially suits them?
Mark Anderson. You're muted, Mark.
Sorry about that. Following on from Dinah's point, it triggered a question in my mind. What is the current status of the Syrian army? Remind me. I was told, but I can't remember, so you'll have to remind me. Does it still exist? Is it disbanded or stood down or what?
Just on that, I don't think it's been disbanded. I think a lot of it refused to fight or was basically told not to fight. It's debatable which, because it's a bit murky. We know that there are men that they were paid a pittance. They really were paid a pittance at the end because of the impact of sanctions on Iraq. But its GDP fell by about 80% or something in the last 15 years or so because of the sanctions. So, you know, Syria was quite a, not a wealthy country, but a middling country. It's become a poor country because of the US sanctions and the Caesar sanctions, particularly, but it's produced a rapid decline in economic, sort of power, and the power to pay its own soldiers a reasonable rate. You know, I think even senior officers were getting about $40 a month or something, which is absurdly low, you know. But yeah, I don't think the army has been disbanded. I think it's probably in practice fragmented, and there are elements who are trying to form a resistance movement, who are actually people who were in the army. It's quite senior people, as I understand it. Others have been murdered. Yeah, there have been widespread murders of Syrian soldiers. People go around and just kill them, you know.
Thank you for that. This is the concern, though. Israel's bid for greater Israel, if they are without an army, then we could be looking at another Gaza in the future, a giant one.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's
so they've got to get their act together. Thanks.
Yes. Anybody else wants to speak? Okay, if no one else wants to speak, should we widen this up and go on to any other business or what? Do you think that's okay? Does anybody else want to make it to Tony? Yeah.
No, I don't know. Sorry, I came to the meeting a bit late. So I don't know if you mentioned anything about the Kurds.
Uh-huh, I did actually, yeah.
The role of, you know, the... Maybe if you say something about that.
Sure. Well, I mean, the Kurds are in conflict with Turkey primarily now. They have been in conflict with the Assad regime at various times on pretty much the same basis as they've been in conflict with Turkey and Iran and Iraq, Arab regimes in all those countries. I mean, the Kurdish demand for autonomy and self-determination is something we, you know, at least in theory, agree with. The problem is that they tend to ally with imperialists at times and can be instrumental in denying self-determination to the Arab population, particularly, you know, when they collaborate with imperialist interventions in Syria and in Iraq. You know, that has happened. It doesn't negate their right to self-determination, but it does put a different complexion on it on sometimes. But actually, in the last period, despite that, there has actually been some element of alliance between between Assad and elements of the Kurdish population, simply for defence against ISIS and against Al Qaeda. It's been unstable. It's fluctuated, But there are many people in Syria who were not particularly fond of Assad, and particularly not fond of Assad's father, have said the earlier harder Assad regime were not particularly fond of that at all. Who came to see Bashar Assad's government as a lesser evil to the various sectarian lunatics, I suppose you could call them, the various sectarian militarist Islamists who basically threatened to exterminate those they didn't like in religious terms. You know, the one positive aspect of the Assad regime is it was secular, and it didn't actually persecute anyone for their religious beliefs, which is something in the Middle East today. You know, it's something to grab hold of. You know, it's something that is the basis for some elements of a bloc. You know, and I think it was correct to back Assad against the various Islamists and other, you know, sort of imperialist backed forces who threatened to overthrow it. And they wanted to. I mean, basically, what they've done now is they've finally succeeded in doing a Libya. You know, the chaos that's going on in Syria portends what happened in Libya. And what happened in Libya was after Gaddafi was overthrown was really, really horrendous. You know, and that is happening in Syria. Hopefully, there will be resistance to it. There are forces that will put a stop to it, but we can't be sure of that. You know, it's pretty bad, actually. That's my view of it, anyway.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. I think Turkey, I mean, my impression is Turkey was pretty cynical about using ISIS to against the Kurds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
You know, there's no doubt about that.
Yeah, I do agree.
Yeah. Anyway, okay.
All right, yeah. Anybody else want to speak?
Yeah.
Should we switch the video, switch the recording off and go on to any other business then, if nobody else wants to speak, yeah? Is that all right? Okay, I'll stop the recording and we'll go on to point on any other business, okay? Cheers.